Good morning and welcome back to the official Jaguar Report podcast. This is episode 94. It's been a minute since we recorded. Last time we talked, we went over free agency, but now we're going to go over a little bit of draft takes and discuss the Josh Allen contract extension since that just happened 2 days ago. But first, John, it's been a second. How have you been?
Yeah, it has been a second. I've been I'm here, man. I'm vertical when I wake up. That's about, well, obviously, there's a lot been going on this side of the world. So we'll discuss everything when the dust settles. But for now, we're still here talking Jaguars football. Probably will be until they put us in the dirt, guys. So here we are, my friend. Episode 94. Who would have thought?
Who would have thought? Six away from the big triple digit mark. We still got to plan something for that. It'll definitely be a very last-minute thing, but these are reminders as we get closer and closer.
Yeah, that's I'll make an Aldi's run when that happens.
that sounds good. Perfect. All right, so like I said, let's start out with the Josh Allen extension. I mean, maybe you got like a little bit of whisper saying that it was coming a couple hours or the day before, but just generally speaking, what was your reaction to it happening now?
So when I first saw it, I was like in my living room, like doing something, and the wife had said, "Hey, Josh Allen just signed." And I thought she was pulling my leg, guys. She has before, but I mean, my immediate takeaways were like, good for Josh Allen. Obviously, this has long been a space that's advocated for paying, Josh Allen. I was in the 1010 studio with Tony yesterday for Jaguars Today. And I remember being in there that same show like a year earlier. And Tony and I both had the opinion then. We were like, I'd pay Josh Allen that kind of money now. And then just to see him like have the kind of contract year that he had, I thought that was one of the best comments that he made like at his press conference. He was like, I didn't play good just because it was a contract year, but luckily it ended up being a contract year. So I thought obviously good for him. I thought like good for the Jaguars to the extent of, there's obviously that stat that since 2010, they've now only extended 3 first round picks, Tyson Alalu, which I feel like that should barely count. Blake Bortles, which was a abomination of a move. And then now Josh Allen. And the obvious retort is, well, how many other first-rounders have they drafted worth, extending? They're not losing sleep over not extending Luke Jokel and Dante Fowler, et cetera. But when you stretch it out to the second round and third round since 2010, that's only 6 more players. Guys like Allen Robinson, Unique Ngakoue, Jalen Ramsey, like great players have been in Jacksonville before. They just, at least young ones, haven't really stuck around. So he's the first cornerstone I feel like they've had in a while. And secondly, I haven't read your article on it yet. I saw you did a big Josh Allen piece that in which you say that you hate, the contract obviously now, but I haven't read it yet, but I agree with you. Like this is a super team. Player friendly deal.
It's catchy, man.
They cashed out. Him and his agent cashed out. But I will say for the Jaguars, like, as maybe begrudgingly as like they, wanted to make that kind of deal. One, the market dictated it. And two, I've criticized the front office enough on this subject, but the one thing I'll give them is like in terms of like contract, negotiations and for this level of deal, relatively like clean and, drama free, which the Jaguars haven't had in a while. And you see a bunch of these other teams of guys who are tagged or guys who are ready to get paid where it doesn't go as smooth. And it never really felt like the situation had ever went south like that as much as big media had tried to generate it, looking at you over there. But
that's true. I know when he got franchise tagged, it wasn't even because of the franchise tag, but just because of the report from Florio of Pro Football Talk that said that Baalke hadn't even reached out to Allen's camp yet. And then Allen talked a little bit about a contract extension during the Pro Bowl. And so I wrote an article then saying, are the Jags risking a contract holdout? Because I think when Allen last year skipped the voluntary portion of workouts, he was just working on himself and he has the right to do that because it is voluntary. But people were starting to get a little bit nervous then. And I thought, maybe he's just doing his thing and that's all there is to it. But maybe it was a little bit of a warning shot too, and just to say like, hey, I would like a deal. I know in Michael DiRocco's ESPN piece on Wednesday when he reported the contract, he said that Trent Baalke did not offer a contract extension to Josh Allen last offseason. And so, like, obviously there's a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff that we might not know. Like, maybe there was a little bit of negotiating behind the scenes, but then, like, the two sides weren't really close. There wasn't, like, an official offer on the table. But either way, it didn't happen last offseason. And then we know Baalke's rule of never doing anything in season. And then, like, when after the season, when the talks hadn't even started yet, then it was, like, a little bit of a warning sign for me. But, yeah, ever since then, it's been pretty, I don't know, not stress-free, but, like, there hasn't really been a lot of panic. And I don't think that really started until, like, training camp really began, honestly, or like OTAs began in late May. And so the fact that it happened then was, or now, is surprised me, because I thought there was a good chance that the deal would end up getting done. But I did think it was going to be similar to Evan Engram last year and Cam Robinson the year before, where I'm pretty sure both players signed in roughly mid-July, definitely after the draft. And so I thought that's kind of where we were headed. And so the news kind of like ruined my whole workout routine, because I was trying to start going to the gym in the mornings before work this week, and it went well Monday and Tuesday. And then Wednesday I walk in and I feel my phone buzz, and it's the Josh Allen news. So then I have to walk back out and write the story, and then I've been busy with this other story. It messed up the routine, but it's okay. And so the story that I just published on Big Cat is kind of going over his contract, and the initially reported value was $150 million, and then Pro Football Talk said a couple hours later, actually, it's $141 million.
Mike Florio won't let that happen.
Obviously, like, not just for the Allen deal, but like for every single like contract that's announced by Schefter or Rappaport, like they always put up like the gaudy numbers, like that very maximum amount that the player could possibly earn, which is like never actually the case. Like, even if Josh Allen is like, wins a Super Bowl and wins Defensive Player of the Year, like, chances of him, like, I don't know, finishing this contract, like, just the way that it is, and like the high end or the low end part of it, like, players just aren't going to get the 100% dollar amount that's originally reported. And so a lot of my article was kind of like going over the quote unquote actual details of the deal. And when it was initially reported, it was like just barely over Brian Burns's deal, which makes sense, because I think in terms of like the whole negotiating process, once Allen didn't get a deal before the season or during the 2023 season, it made sense for him and his camp to wait until free agency happened so that they could look at a deal like Brian Burns and say, okay, we're going to take just barely something over that, because they're both drafted first round in 2019. And I think Burns has 46 career sacks and Allen has 45 career sacks. So they're very similar, like, free agent profiles or whatever. And we saw, I think, especially last off season with like the way that quarterback extensions were stacked one on top of each other. Yeah. I think Lamar and then Burrow and then Herbert and then Hurts, or it was like those four quarterbacks in some kind of order. And like whichever order it was, they just kept barely like nudging whatever the previous quarterback contract was. And so it makes sense that Allen's reported deal was like just barely above Brian Burns's. But then when you actually look at like how likely they are to make however much of their contract is likely, it's much more likely that Allen takes home like $20 million more.
Yeah.
Based on this app that was made by PFF's Arjun Menon and Brad Spielberger. And so, yeah, basically just the takeaway from the article is that the Jags overpaid Josh Allen, which you didn't even really need like the specific contract details to know. It's just that like he had a contract year, he had 17 and a half sacks, which his previous career high was 10.5, so like they were always going to kind of overpay him, but just like from a technical number standpoint, it's probably a little bit more than he's worth. But the title of the headline was, or the title of the story was, the Jaguars overpaid Josh Allen, and that's okay, because I mean, he makes such a big impact on the field, in the locker room, in the community. Like, that's the kind of guy you would want to overpay.
Yeah. I agree with you, like, in principle and in theory. However, I'm not going to criticize the overpay in the vacuum of, like, you had a Jacksonville Jaguars. Eventually, like, you need to, you know, keep one of these guys here. Yeah. With that said, I feel like the bigger criticism is about the process itself, not necessarily they overpaid for him, but the timing of it. And contract negotiations are like such a fluid, complicated thing that I'm sure there's plenty of arguments that you can make in favor of the Jaguars front office, you know, well, with Josh Allen's agency, want to sign a contract early, et cetera, that kind of thing. But other teams do it. It still happens, you know, like it's very much a thing that happens. So it very much feels like the Jaguars are always kind of reacting to the market instead of getting ahead of it, which I think is the main takeaway that you can have here. It feels like unless they like sign Trevor now, they're like never early on these things.
No, you know? Like that's what my take. Like the last line of my story was literally, are the Jags going to be reactive or proactive with the Trevor Lawrence extension? Like that's like the Allen deal is what it is. Maybe he's a little bit overpaid technically again, but again, it's worth it.
Cap's going up.
But yeah, like I don't know. Even if the two sides weren't actually close to a deal last offseason, like maybe they just should have been. Like all of the like underlying metrics, that was kind of like the other half of the story. Like besides just looking at like what the actual contract was compared to Burns and other players, it was also the fact that like he had underlying like pressure metrics and other stuff that suggested he was a better player than his like sack production would have suggested entering the 2023 season. And then like because you waited around for the sack production to eventually catch up to the underlying metrics that like already said he was a really good pass rusher, and now you're paying like even above full price. I'm with you where it's like more about the process than anything.
It definitely feels like it was like hashtag sacks or like the big reason why he wasn't, you know, paid anytime. And neither one of us predicted him to have 17 and a half sacks. But I feel like we were saying before the season that like everything suggests he's going to have like a good year, you know, like that's like, that's my whole thing. I think, I guess with the sack argument is like, you can still predict when guys are going to break out, in my opinion. And I also think, you know, for Josh Allen, I don't know, maybe it's a bit of a hyperbolic, maybe it's cliche, but I feel like he's still so early in his career that like last year was like the first year really of like this phase of Josh Allen. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like he unlocked a part of his game, and I feel like the next, he had what, 45 sacks in his first 5 years. I think he'll have more than that in the next 5 years, which you probably would expect with, you know, a contract like that. And then that's almost getting in the, you know, 100 sack range. And, you know, if he finishes out this contract, that's a decade with the team. You know, he'll obviously be the franchise leader in sacks sooner or later. He's only 10 and a half away. He's probably going to end up the best Jags defender ever, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think like a good question to ask now is like, not necessarily like where he ranks current day, but like where he's on pace to rank
in terms
of Jags greats. And I think you're right. I think he's on pace to be the greatest defender ever.
Yeah, I'd argue he's probably top 10 today. Like just like looking at his resume. I mean, that also kind of speaks like to the Jaguars pass rush history. You know, they and like Calais is like one of the top guys in there. He was there for like objectively in like NFL like time, like for like a cup of coffee, basically.
Yeah, so yeah.
I think, you know, you obviously have to talk about Mike Smith. Not Mike Smith, Jesus. Mike Peterson, Rasheen Mathis, obviously, John Henderson, Tony Brackens, Kevin Hardy. Like, there's a lot of guys who are probably up there ahead of him right now. But he's ahead, like, he's ahead of, like, the Pauses of the world, right? Like, he's ahead of Paws.
Yeah.
Marcus Stroud, Donovan Darius, I think. Those kind of guys. Like, my opinion, his name's going to be on the stadium by the time that he retires, which no defender is right now. Like, I know people probably would like to see Mathis on there, maybe Daryl Smith, Mike Peterson, etc. But I think he's going to be the first defender with his name on there. But in terms of who got bulky balled on this, it definitely feels like the Jags got painted into a corner, right? Which,
oh, they got so bulky balled, man.
To show some empathy, it must suck being an NFL GM, because you and I have been sitting here trashing the guy for not paying Josh Allen, and now he pays Josh Allen.
Yeah.
I did it, and now we're here saying no. Yeah. You did it. You can't win. That does seem awful, but like I said, I agree with you in the general sense that, yeah, it probably is an overpay if you want to get technical. But on the other hand, I'm just such like a fan of the player, the fit, the person, the skill set, that I think at the end of the day, cap going up is the perfect, you know, copium. It'll age fine.
Yeah, for sure. And even like looking at the contract numbers on over the cap, I think he has a cap hit of $40 million for a single season, like 3 or 4 years down the road.
Yeah.
Then the other cap hits are like really not that bad. And so I think in terms of like looking to the future for not just a Trevor Lawrence extension, but just like their cap space in general for the future, I don't think it really prevents them from Trevor extension or like other extensions like Tyson Campbell or Andre Sisco, or like going out to get like a guy like Ayuk or T Higgins, which is probably like very much a long shot, but like it's not like they're like cap constrained or restrained because of the deal at all.
Yeah. So those are my next two questions. One is they have like 30 plus million in cap space right now. I think they're like top three or something like that in like available cap space. Very convenient very convenient that that happens like a month after free agency ends, et cetera. But what is your guess that they do with all that cap space? My thought is, one, we know, like, just as a general practice, they like entering the season with some cap space. You know, it just gives you that flexibility to make a move if you need to, like Ezra Cleveland, you know, type move last year, you know, Calvin Ridley a few years ago, et cetera. They just like having that flexibility in season to take on a deal. And then could that money be earmarked, you think, either for like taking part in the AFC South arms race and adding another guy, making a big move, or is it more likely that money goes to Trevor Lawrence on an extension before the season starts?
Ooh. I think it's more likely that the money like ends up going to Trevor. And I don't think they like necessarily cleared cap space for the sole reason of like either the arms race or a Trevor extension.
True.
So I think like having the money for the Lawrence extension makes more sense and is more likely. But yeah. I think absolutely the door is still open for the Jaguars to add a big name wide receiver. I think they're going to be like looking at the big three receivers in the draft, but especially Malik Nabers and Rome Odunze. And if they fall to like 8 or 9, that would make the most sense for a trade up spot to really make sure you get them. But then I think if either of them falls to 12 at the Broncos, that's like the trade up spot, just because the Broncos, I'm assuming they're not going to trade up for a quarterback because they don't have a lot of draft capital. And so if you're right. He's totally wrong. Let me back
up. I have no idea the Broncos. They're such a wild card.
I think there's a decent chance the Broncos do take a first round quarterback, but I think if they don't, which there's definitely a big chance that doesn't happen, then they're going to be very interested in trading back and trying to acquire picks. Because even if Sean Payton is kind of like running the building and he wants to win now, even though that roster is in no shape to, like, hopefully there'll be an adult in the room somewhere in Denver saying, no, we need to like step back a little bit and get some capital. So I think 12 makes the most sense in terms of like, if Rome or Malik ends up somehow falling there, then maybe trade up to 12. Then I think as soon as the first three receivers are off the board, then the Jags will kind of like pivot to T. Higgins and Brandon Ayuk, and then start like kind of re-engaging in conversations with the Niners and the Bengals about those two players. And I think that they're going to be in a spot where like maybe even similar to like Allen last year, where they're comfortable paying a certain amount, but don't want to go too high. Like I wouldn't be surprised if, cause like we've seen reports that they're like interested in receivers. And I mean, arguably most of those reports are just like them doing their homework. And so I wouldn't be surprised if the same thing happens in the draft, where like a report comes out that a trade almost happened for T. Higgins, but then like in reality, it was more of just them like giving the Bengals a call just to double check on Higgins, like once Odunze and Nabers go off the board. But like the point is, like, I think the door is very much open to that possibility, even if it's a small possibility.
But there's value in having the flexibility to do something, you know, like even if they don't do anything, it's at least, you know, it's nice to have the insurance to know that you can. I don't know. I'd say Ayuk trade, I think, would be more likely than Higgins. I don't think, just even for the Jaguars, I think for all teams. I really think the Bengals are going to sit on Higgins this year. Like I think they're gonna, I think they're gonna say they get more out of it by having him on the roster, you know, this fall. I mean, Jesse Bates did the same thing. He was franchise tagged, said he wanted to get traded, sat out for a couple practices, and eventually was like, okay, they're not budging, and he ended up playing and then leaving. I think same thing is gonna happen to T. Higgins. I think that owner and that I think their front office, I think, are comfortable and just kind of putting the foot down and being like, who cares, more or less. So yeah. I ultimately don't think Higgins will get traded. I'm prepared to look like an idiot on that. Trevor Lawrence, over under $250 million contract if he signed it before week one.
All right, well, I got to pull up
over the cap. There's value in paying him before Dak gets paid, right?
Oh, totally. I mean,
yeah.
Like, who knows like if that, Dak will get paid, but yeah, absolutely.
That's the argument to make for paying him now, I would think, right, is that Dak and Tua are probably both the next big contracts up, and it's better to be the first to sign than the last, as you know, you mentioned.
So I think not only over 250, I think over 275 million total value is going to be what Lawrence gets.
Because right now, which quarterback have that?
Mahomes has $450,000 in total value on his contract because it was like 10 years or whatever. Burrow is second with $275,000. So that's kind of like the mark to hit because he was like the most recent contract extension. And then before him was Herbert at $262 million. I've been saying thousand, but it's million. And then Lamar Jackson, $260 million before him. Before him, Josh Allen at $258 million. Before him, Jalen Hurts at $255 million. So like I was saying earlier, like these like contracts just like stack up one against another, like just depending on what the most recent one was. And so since the most recent non-Mahomes contract was Joe Burrow at a total value of $275 million, I'm saying over.
Josh Allen's like the best value on there, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. That Jalen Hurts number is abysmal. So more in Burrow, you think?
I mean, I 100% think he should make more than Burrow. And then,
Just if a report came out tomorrow that he had signed the contract, what do you think? I'll plant my flag and say 265.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, let me write this down since we're on different sides, and then hopefully I'll remember to bring it back.
I want there to be a winner of this.
All right, Shipley's going 265.
Yeah.
How about we just set the line at 265, and I'll take the over, you take the under?
266, make the...
265.5. It's got to be like half now.
Yeah.
All right, 265.5. Shipley's got the under. I've got the over. Life's too short to bet the under. Okay, so here's my question now is like, what percentage chance would you give the Jaguars of signing Lawrence to an extension? 50-50, above, lower? This offseason, if I wasn't clear.
Oh, man. Let's go. Let me do some math. Wait. 58-42, is that equal 100?
That checks out.
Yeah, okay.
58-42. So a little bit above 50%.
Yeah, I'm waffling on that one. I think it makes sense to do it just because, like I said, it's better to be early than to be reacting and seeing Tua and the absolute aberration that's going to be that, you know, contract. And then obviously Dak will probably get maybe not as much total, but he'll probably get a ton guaranteed and, you know, per year whenever he does get paid, whether that's by the Cowboys or, you know, if he had free agency, he'd get more in the Kirk contract. So I think it's makes sense to do it. And it makes sense for them to like just get it over with so they can focus on like the other deals and know what they're working with. But on the other hand, it's also like, is each side really rushing to get it done? You know, like I'm sure, like Trevor's camp, you have to think you're getting paid. Either, like what are the Jaguars going to do? Say we're not paying you. Like you're getting paid either way. So does it make more sense for him to have another year with, you know, better things going on around him to increase his value? Or
I think it's pretty similar to Josh Allen, honestly, because I think like going into last year, Balking in the front office could have just pointed at the sack production and been like, he's a good player, but he's not, hasn't shown that he's top tier yet. So we're not going to offer him a top tier contract. And then I think with Trevor, you can similarly like point to just like basic statistics, like yards per attempt and completion percentage and stuff like that. That may be like I'm sure Trevor fares better. I know you hate the over expectation stats, but like in completion percentage over expectation and like stats that actually have a lot more context, he's probably better. But even still, like for a first overall pick, like his general stats haven't been awesome. And so plus like with like the four injuries that he sustained last year, I think that's the biggest part. They'll probably be like, well, we're not going to offer him a top tier contract since he hasn't showed that he can like make a Super Bowl like Joe Burrow, even though that was a fraudulent run by Burrow. It was carried by Big Lou. But yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if that's the way it turns out. I think the main thing that has me thinking it could be this offseason is just that, A, there's already been reports that there are like contract negotiation talks between Lawrence's camp and the Jaguars. And then B, just the fact that Josh Allen's contract came in earlier than we expected. And so maybe it's like they're trying to, because I know Josh said during his presser on Wednesday that it was important to both sides that he signed before OTAs began. And I feel like it would be the same way for Trevor Lawrence. And like you kind of saw that last year with quarterback extensions too. Like they all wanted to make sure their quarterback got signed before training camp stuff started so that it wasn't like a distraction during practices and stuff like that. And so I wonder if like the reason that Allen's deal got done sooner than like Engram and Robinson's deal got done in the past year and two is because like they're like, okay, we gotta need to get this done so that we can get Lawrence's done deal too before training camp.
Makes sense. I really think that, like you said, there are a lot of signs pointing to where it very easily could be something that happens. I guess my, you know, sitting on the fence take is I really wouldn't be, you know, surprised either way. I don't know, man. Does this contract story lack the juice? I'm just, it's not something that I think is like overly like excitable. I don't know what it is.
I wasn't thinking about it at all until like, I know DeRocco and someone from the Times Union both wrote pieces that were like, Josh Allen's done. Trevor Lawrence is up next, which makes sense.
Which, like it was at this time and those other guys, like it was at this time in Herbert's career, you know, and Burrow's career that they got paid. So like they can point to similar things. If the Jags wanted to play hardball, Trent would just pass a phone quietly across the table and it would just be the Daniel Jones, Trevor Lawrence, CBS Sports. Oh, that thing's never going away.
Yeah, it'll be tough to see because if like
that tweet gets like rebranded like every like month.
If we do get to the regular season without a Lawrence extension, though, like it'll be pretty tough to say whether it's because Lawrence didn't want to sign for less than he was worth or the Jags didn't want to offer more than they thought he was worth. Like that stuff is always tough to gauge, even if there is a report or two that kind of comes out of it. So I wanted to ask you about the Stephon Diggs deal, too, because that happened at some point since we last recorded. And so my thought is that just in terms of relating it to the Jaguars and I guess what we were just talking about, I think it makes it harder to trade for Brandon Ayuk or T. Higgins. Cause in my eyes,
they were paid
on the trade before like the contract details came out, but then like 2 or 3 days after the deal was announced, there was reports that Diggs will only be playing for the Texans like in 2024 and it'll basically be a prove it year. So they gave up a second rounder for a 1 year rental.
It was a Galaxy brand. Yeah. It screwed up like the receiver trade market more or less. Right.
Yeah, exactly. And so like, if you're giving a second round pick for a 1 year rental of an aging disgruntled wide receiver, then like how much is like a young receiver going to go for? Who's like,
you said wide receiver, the same disgust as aging.
Well, you know that good tweet that's like wide receiver tweets are the weirdest because it was like the enemy kindly holds a knife or whatever it is. But yeah, there's a lot of,
I still think he's good.
Is the wrong word because it's don't know. It seems
I still think he's good.
Yeah, I think so too. I think it actually like makes sense for the Texans in terms of like an on paper fit, just because both Nico Collins and Tank Dell can win deep, and so they'll be able to have like a reliable, like intermediate mid range guy, which will be big for them, because they were like, even though Dell and Collins were both awesome last year, like they kind of needed a little bit more depth to round out the room, especially obviously like Tank Dell ended the season on IR, I'm pretty sure, and so Diggs definitely had a big statistical drop off from the first half of his 2023 season compared to the second half. But I think a lot of it was just that, like, he couldn't really separate deep as well as he used to, but he was still like a valuable target in the short to intermediate range. But then he wasn't as productive because like they already had a couple short to intermediate options and Don Kincaid and James Cook and Khalil Shakir. And so then it almost became like repetitive. And so I think it makes sense for the Bills to kind of like get off of that contract. They do owe a ton of dead money, so it's not like they completely got away from the contract, but like it seemed like it was a legit locker room problem in Buffalo, so for them to kind of like just be done with it, and I don't think it'll really mess up their offense that much, but it could help the Texans offense a ton.
He's a good example for like the issues of like void years and pushing money into the future too, because like if you look at like his contract history, the Bills, he never had a big cap hit because they just kept pushing the money forward. And look at it. There you go. Now, giant dead cap hit. I think as like it relates, you know, like I agree with you. It definitely, the Bills definitely won the trade. It definitely looks like a very odd trade, you know, per the conditions as of now. But I feel like Caserio has made like quite a few, like even the Will Anderson trade, as much as I love Will Anderson, that was a weird trade. it was
kind of a knucklehead move. People were like, I remember nerds were so upset last year because they were like, the Texans first round pick is going to be so high though. What are they doing? And then obviously like it worked out a little bit for Houston where they made the playoffs. And so
for
like,
sure,
the first rounder this year that they're sending to the Cardinals is not nearly as low of a draft pick. Or like,
would anyone have cared if they just took Will Anderson second and then traded up for CJ Stroud?
No, but it's just that like it's not really like a great look for like the team or the player in terms of CJ. Like if you take your franchise player after, or your franchise quarterback after a different player, even if it's another franchise player like Will Anderson is, it's like a weird, not even like not great, just a weird look to take the quarterback.
That's over
fair. Quarterback. Or,
that's fair.
Quarterback behind a non-quarterback. So
I feel like how like all this pertains to the Jaguars too in terms of the trade is like the AFC South in general is like gearing up, you know, on weapons. But like signing Ronald Darby and Darnell Savage is not like the end all for a secondary. And that's not like for me to say criticize them, because the secondary in July and in August is going to look different than what it looks like now. You know, like there's still an entire NFL draft, you know, to go. So not to criticize the current depth chart, but it's obvious that they still need help. You know, like they simply cannot enter the season without a substantial move in the back end, you know, even with, you know, some of the new faces. So I like it to me, if they're thinking that they need to go get, you know, like a top cornerback talent in this draft, I completely understand why.
For sure. All right. That's a good segue. Should we get some draft talk?
Yeah, we will. We will right after this break. We'll be right back.
All right. So, John, we're going to talk draft. The last time that we spoke, I'm sure that we were both in agreement that cornerback was both the number one need for the Jaguars entering the draft and also like the number one most likely position to be drafted in the first round. And then obviously with Stephon Diggs being added to the division, I don't think that's changed for either of us. My first take to start us off, though, is that while I still think that cornerback is the most likely, like the most likely scenario for the Jaguars is that they're going to take the best available cornerback on their board at 17th overall. I think there's a decent chance that they take an offensive lineman and they take a corner, like whoever the best cornerback is on their board in the second round. And I think it's most has a lot to do with the way that the draft shaked out last year. These Baalke did a good job of not just like getting kind of like the last guy in the first year or whatever at offensive tackles, but also like moving down and still getting his guy. But even if he didn't move down, it was a good job of kind of recognizing where the strength was in the draft class and making sure you didn't kind of like screw yourself in a later round. And so I feel like they could kind of do something similar this year, because like the offensive tackle class, not that it has like weak depth, but it's just so star-studded at the top that I wouldn't be surprised if they see a run on offensive tackles and they're like, okay, we better make sure we get one now, especially because I feel like any team from the Titans at 7th overall to the Seahawks at 16th overall, like the majority of teams in that span are probably looking at offensive line upgrades. And so I think there's a good chance that there's going to be a run on offensive linemen, and the Jags are going to say, even though we definitely need corners, like we'd rather get an offensive lineman that we like while we can, rather than like kind of starting the trend or starting the run on cornerbacks. Because if like somehow like Terron Arnold and Quinnen Mitchell, like if there isn't a cornerback available, or if there isn't a cornerback that's been selected by the time the 17th pick rolls around, I just think they're going to be more willing to like take offensive line because there's already a run on it, rather than starting the run of corners for everyone else. Does that make sense?
No, there's a really good chance that an offensive lineman like is like straight up the best player available at 17. You know, I think like just like looking at this class, I agree with you. Like the value, I think, is in offensive line at that pick. If you're just talking about best pure value, you know, like you just not even factoring in need and all that, because this is a special, you know, offensive line class, and there are almost, it feels like, too many, you know, offensive linemen who are projected to be like top 20 guys. And, you know, it, in my thinking, say they get the 17 and two of these guys are still on there, like a Fatu'anu or, you know, Graham Barden or whoever, I feel like that'd be a pretty good scenario for them to move down. And then either you move down and you catch one of these guys who are still there, or you got more picks and you took advantage of, you know, an offensive lineman flying off the board and can take your cornerback. I think it makes a lot of sense. And yes, like the offensive line is relatively set like today, like due to their own doing. And I feel like both of us have said that like Trent doesn't really pick backups in the first round. But again, if you want to go just straight up best player available, there's a good chance it's an offensive lineman. And I do think like people love to complain about offensive lines, but people hate investing in them. Like eventually, like, you know, it makes sense to take advantage of this class. It makes sense for a lot of teams too. So I think what you said makes a lot of sense.
And the other side of it is that it's not just that the offensive line class is so good, it's that the cornerback class is, I would say, like kind of the opposite, where it's more deep than it is star-studded. Like absolutely, Terron Arnold and Quinnen Mitchell are first round caliber players, but I think they're more of like probably like the 20th overall prospect on a lot of big boards. Whereas like Fatu'anu and even Graham Barden, I would say, are probably going to be graded higher for most teams. And so I think there's just going to be like higher graded offensive linemen available there than corners, but there'll still be like starting caliber corners available in the second round. I think there's like, I don't know, between Max Mellon
and, I was going to say,
and like Rake Straw, if he falls, and Lassiter, like there's a good group of second round corners available, or that will be available. And so, yeah, I'm glad you mentioned though that like Balky does, bless you, jeez, is that four in a row?
Sorry. I muted myself.
First one go, but then you just kept going.
Yeah, I know. I'm a multi sneezer.
I was gonna say, I like that you brought up that Balky likes to get starters in the first round, which would suggest like that they're gonna get a cornerback in the first round, because even if technically like they plan on Savage starting in the slot and Darby starting at cornerback, like they could upgrade either or both of those spots.
I'm still side-eyeing that. I'm not going to lie to you.
I'm like not writing that in stone. I hope that's not how
you're talking about the sniff. The sniff test on that one isn't exactly passing, but continue. Sorry.
Right. And so then people would say, oh, but like the five offensive line starters are like already set in stone. And that may be true, but like no offensive line for all five guys goes through a season fully healthy. And obviously,
somebody's going to get hurt.
Yeah. Obviously, last year was like a little bit extreme in terms of like Cam getting suspended and then getting hurt later on, Walker getting hurt, like Walker Little getting hurt about 10 snaps into playing guard for the first time. Ezra getting banged up as soon as he was brought in from the trade, et cetera, et cetera. But like I don't know. I was talking to a buddy of mine. He's like, I don't know, an edge rusher would make more sense, because even if an edge rusher isn't a need either, like at least an edge rusher would like get some snaps every game behind Josh Allen and Trayvon Walker. And so that's just kind of my take, is that even if an offensive lineman hopefully isn't going to start the first week or even the 10th week, like offensive linemen get hurt. And so especially if you're getting someone like Troy Fautano or Graham Barton, who can hypothetically play multiple spots on the line, then that could be a really valuable pick, even if it doesn't seem like a day one starter immediately.
If they got like a Troy Fautano and say Max Mellon at 48, that's like a home run. Like,
yeah, man. That's what I'm saying. I think, again, I think that cornerback round one is more likely. And then I think like the very unlikely scenario is some kind of move for a wide receiver. But then like my middle ground scenario is just taking like best player available, which is probably going to be offensive lineman in the first round, and then coming back to corner in the second.
Okay, so let's put you in the big boy chair. You know, you're GM. Would you say your options are Mitchell / Arnold, like, is the ideal scenario to happen, right?
Yeah.
And probably then
Arnold, because even though they're like similar prospects, Arnold is just a much better fit for the scheme, I think.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I do think Mitchell to a man scheme is, not to say he can't do it, but it is like a projection. Like he was like strictly like off coverage, like reading the quarterback at, you know, Toledo.
And he also played like very minimal slot snaps, and so I think that would like someone with the versatility.
And I personally put zero stock into senior bowl performances. Like I think he's a really good prospect because he has good tape, elite production, and elite measurables. You know, I take zero weight in anything that happens in Mobile and anything. So with that said,
honestly, that's a good way to go about it, because everyone else puts way too much stake into it. So
no, like he didn't need like the Senior Bowl to be like. Have you seen like looked at like his stats from Toledo? He has the best production in the class. Like he to me like film production, athleticism, measurables, however you want to, you know, really consume how they do that. But obviously athletic testing, it's like 33%, 33%, 33% to me. I think it's probably the best way to look at, you know, a lot of prospects. Obviously college production is unique context, hit and miss, etc. So getting past that. So those two, would you say, are the top two options? After that, would you say one of like the first round tier offensive lineman, and in that tier, I think we can say Joe Alt's out of the question. Obviously, I don't feel like Penn State's left tackle is out of the question entirely. I could see him being like a top 20 pick. So including him, including Graham Barton, including Oregon State tackle. I just don't want to butcher the names.
I think it's Water.
Yeah, including Fat Hawk. including Washington tackle,
okay.
Including J.C. Latham,
okay.
Are you putting Mims in there? Or are you putting him below them? I think he should be in there. I think he's going to get drafted later in that. I think he is going to be a late first round guy.
I think him and Tyler Guyton are like probably going to go late first. But like if they went anywhere from like 15th to 35th or even 45th, it probably wouldn't surprise me.
So are you including Mims in the group of offensive linemen that you would take at 17? I guess is the question I'm asking.
That's really tough. He's borderline to me. Cause I think it's a good cutoff, honestly. Cause like, I think Fulaga and Fautano, so the Washington and Oregon State tackles.
Thank you.
I think they would both be like automatic, like run to the podium type picks, because I think they're just like both top of the like first tier offensive line, like you just said. But then also like what makes them even better for the Jaguars specifically is that they're like probably going to be best as guards in the NFL, but they definitely aren't like pigeonholed as guards. Like they're probably best as guards, but they could still play tackle hypothetically. And so I think, and then like Graham Barton could play really any of the five positions.
Graham Barton's in this group, right? At like guys you would take at 17.
I think he's not maybe to casuals or to the public quite yet, but yeah.
I want your takes. If I wanted the public's takes, I'd ask them. And I'm not asking.
So Mims is tough because I could totally see like Balky and even Phil Rauscher like falling in love with the measurables and the tape and the potential and all that. He's awesome. And then like we've joked in the past about how like Balky likes to buy low on injured guys, and Mims, like part of the ding on his profile is that he hasn't played a lot of games, mostly because of injuries. And so I don't know. I think he's gonna end up falling past 17 or 20 even.
I think he's gonna go late first because he's only started like what, like 6 or 7 games in his career. Like,
yeah,
so he'd obviously, if he hits, he'll be like Pro Bowl level player. So
I'll put him below the tier, but he's like worth talking about and worth mentioning.
Okay, he's below your tier. I'm gonna include him in mine. So the two corners.
Yep.
Let me get my hand reviewed. Two corners. Okay. The group of offensive linemen would be a second best option. What about after them? What are some other options at 17 that you think would be tolerable? Is there a receiver other than the big three? One of the defensive tackles, Cooper, DeJean, or Nate Wiggins? Are there any other, you know, scenarios that you think are enticing, or is it really the top two corners or one of these linemen that fall?
I think it's basically like those two positions and then like several names or multiple names in those positions. And then it comes down to like best player available, like a single best player available at other positions. Like I think Latu, the edge rusher out of UCLA, he has a suspect profile because he medically retired with a neck injury a couple of years ago. And so his medical is all over the place. I did see a report that like most teams have medically cleared him, which is a good sign, but still a little bit of a red flag. But I think his tape is good enough. Like he's so sudden that I think he's like a top 10 talent in the class. And so I think like, even if like a Jared Verse and even a Dallas Turner are like going to go in like the 8 to 20 range, I think like Latu is the only one among them that's like really worth taking because he's like has that much of a higher grade, at least for me. And then similar for defensive tackle, I think Johnny Newton is in that class where he's like, even if it's not a position of need for the first round, he's just such a good talent that you got to consider taking him.
Byron Murphy.
I think Byron.
Give us a take.
I wouldn't hate the pick.
You'd hate it.
I don't think I would.
A leak on it and set it on fire.
He makes me nervous because you know the thing that he does where he like falls down on his knee when he's double teamed. It's kind of impressive because you're like, he like kind of like finishes the rep and it's good contact balance. But at the same time, it's like if you're going down on your knee all the time at the college level, like what's going to happen when you're going against NFL defensive lines?
He's a through tech only to me in the NFL. Like I think John Newton can probably play a few different spots. I think Murphy like can only be like, you know, playing outside of guard shoulder.
I think like I think Murphy is still probably like a first round talent, but like Newton is in like a class of his own to me for that
position.
Where, and like again, same deal as like Latu versus Verse and Turner. Like I wouldn't be pissed if it was Verse or Turner.
Yeah.
But I think like Latu and Newton are like the only two defensive linemen that are like truly going to be the best player available.
Any interest in any of the other cornerbacks? Kool-Aid McKinstry, Cooper DeJean, Nate Wiggins, any interest?
I think Nate Wiggins and Cooper DeJean both have pretty good arguments for being the number one cornerback or even just like defensive back in the class.
I like Wiggins. Even though he's tiny and doesn't tackle, I still like Wiggins, dude.
even though he's
like a 4-2 something.
They're both just like great athletes and probably going to be great pros, but they're just like don't seem like the best Jaguars fits. And so I think that like even if the majority of teams and people have them higher graded or rated than Kool-Aid, I kind of think that Kool-Aid is going to be their cornerback 3 or even cornerback 2 ahead of Quinn Mitchell on their board, because
Kool-Aid is probably the best press corner in the draft.
Exactly. And so yeah, like I think he and Terrion are like not elite prospects because they just because like their athletic profiles are good, not great. Like they just don't really have like the elite whether it's speed or agility or whatever for each of them to keep up with like Justin Jefferson. So the world in the league, they're both like great. And they would be asked to be like number two, maybe even number three corners, which would help out a lot. Like when they're coming in with Tyson and then arguably Ronald Darby in front of them.
If you want to add any cope for a Arnold selection and looking at his athletic profile, compare his to Jalen Johnson's. It is eerie how close they are. That's just to show that like he can be that level of athlete, I think, and still be like a top, you know, potentially.
Yeah, 10. I'm definitely like more nitpicking. It's not that like they don't
have. No, I'm with you.
It's just like what makes them not a perfect prospect.
Yeah, like they're not talked about like Sauce or like Sertan, you know, for a reason. You know, they're talked about in this range, you know, for a reason. I feel is Kool-Aid hitting a double, which I think is fine in a lot of cases, but is Kool-Aid kind of like just a safe, maybe I don't want to say scared, but is it like a conservative pick maybe? Because I feel like there's a very low chance that he's bad, you know, but
yeah,
obviously no, I'm not sure if the upside is there with him as much as with the other guys.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a world where Terrion Arnold and Quinion Mitchell both are off the board before 17. And then it's like the opposite of the offensive tackle scenario that I first brought up. But they're like, okay, there's already been a run starting on cornerbacks. Like, even if Kool-Aid isn't like technically our highest rated player, because there's already cornerbacks going off the board and like we know we need to make sure we get a cornerback, like we're going to go ahead and select him. So I do think it would be kind of a double pick, which I mean a double is still run, you're still getting it on base, but
yeah, it's just hard to envision Kool-Aid's one of the best 17 players in the class, right? Yeah,
I'm trying to think of other positions.
So I mean, okay, talk to me. Is there any receiver outside of the top three that you would take at 17? My personal answer, no. I said it on the radio yesterday, and I very well could look like an idiot for this in 2-3 years, but I think there are three legit top 10 receiver prospects to me, two guys who I would take in the top five, and Harrison and Odunze, and then like a dozen second round receivers. I don't think there's another first round receiver after them. Like maybe a late first, but not a guy that I think is like a clearly like, oh, this guy is one of the 32 best. Like, I don't know. I just think there are more red flags than people want to see with the Thomases and the Mitchells of the class.
No, I'm right there with you. I think like Brian Thomas with like a late first round grade, I'm fine with that. And I honestly think he's going to end up going before the Jaguars' pick. But like, I don't really
agree.
You know, like, I think Colts is like his floor. I think like, cause I know everyone was talking about Xavier Worthy since he broke the combine record with his 40-yard dash, but Brian Thomas's 40-yard dash is even more impressive. Just if you look at like speed score, which is basically like the 40-yard dash with the context of how much a player weighs. Like that's why Justin Fields is like the fastest player in the NFL. Cause even if technically like Devon Achane and Lamar Jackson are faster, like the weight that Justin Fields carries while running as fast as he does is insane. And so sort of similar with Brian Thomas, even if he didn't run technically a faster 40 time than Xavier Worthy, at the weight that he did it, it was the most impressive 40-yard dash at the combine. And so I think like his size and speed combination, especially with like the arms race that's going on in the NFL with wide receivers, not just in the AFC South but across the league, like I think the Colts are going to end up just like having either him or Brock Bowers fall to them, and they're just gonna take one of them. But yeah, I'm with you. Where like I personally wouldn't take Brian Thomas Jr. at 17th or before. And then like with A.D. Mitchell, he's the guy that like I if people talk themselves into a late first round grade, I understand it. But like his effort level on 40% of snaps is absurd, and that's like the kind of thing that like you kind of have to get the players into a building, and like that's like really the point of like top 30 visits and combine visits and all that stuff for the most part. At least with these first round guys, is like for a guy like Latu, just like seeing where his medicals are at. And then with a guy like Mitchell, just seeing where his motivation is at and whether like he really loves ball and like whether he was taking plays off because like it was literally written in the playbook at Texas, like, oh, you don't have to run around this play, or if it's because like he's just like a lazy player and only shows up on plays where he's targeted.
I kind of feel like it's the former, honestly. I don't have any evidence for it. I just know I remember this exact conversation when Baylor was putting out a receiver prospect every year and with Corey Coleman. And it like literally was written into like what they were doing on offense, like for them to not run a route that play. I do think like obviously teams have to do like their background on him. Here's my stance. To me, in terms of acquiring a receiver, I think the ideal scenario is they take one of the following guys at 48. Ladd McConkey, Keon Coleman, Ricky Pearsall, even Xavier Worthy, I think you can throw in there, Troy Franklin, Jalen Polk, Xavier Leggett. You can maybe even make the argument for Roman Wilson, even though I think he's kind of just Christian Kirk and probably wouldn't make as much sense. But I think you have a better chance of getting plus surplus value, taking one of them at 48 as opposed to taking Mitchell or Thomas at 17. And I think you get more value there than if you were to trade up for one of the big three, because it's probably going to cost a future first. And I think trading for one of those three guys makes more sense than like trading for Ayuk or T. Higgins, because it's a wide range of possibilities that like they hit, right? And that they're like 1,000-yard receivers off the bat. You have having one of those guys on a rookie deal like Chase is on right now is immensely valuable, but you're probably going to make a Julio Jones type trade. And I know I would sound like the most boring person at the party, like a wet blanket, but
come on.
It's not a good idea to trade up for one of them, dude. The nerds are right. Like it's
a Julio trade stunk, which it kind of did, but then it worked out because he's a Hall of Famer. But
yeah, like on one hand, you know, you're pushing up the glasses and saying they got terrible value. On the other hand, Julio Jones goes zoom. You know, he was the Falcons. You know, probably weren't exactly beating themselves up over it. But I don't know. I've been swayed. I get more upset at the nerds for getting upset about trading up than I do about the actual trading up, just because I think they make it too big of like it's not an affront to society at the end of the day. Who cares? But I agree with them in terms of the actual take that unless you're trading up for a quarterback, you probably shouldn't trade up, especially when it pertains to like future first and stuff. I know Romo Dunze is going to be awesome. I know Marvin Harrison Jr. is going to be awesome. I know Malik Nabers will be pretty good.
He's
gonna be
awesome. Come on, John.
But I wouldn't trade up for them. I just look at all the receivers that you can potentially find a hit on. Jermaine Burton might go in the fourth or fifth round because he might be a head case, but he could still be like one of the most productive receivers in this class. Like you can find a super productive receiver outside of the first round. So I don't know. I will keep if they trade up for a receiver. I'll keep the takes off the timeline, let people celebrate because I don't feel like being a wet blanket, but it would probably be like a negative move in terms of actual value.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I would even take yours one step further though. Like because all these receivers have been like pushed up half a grade. Like they almost get like the quarterback comp where like Jaden Daniels and McCarthy are both going to be top five or definitely top half of the first round quarterback selected. And like JJ McCarthy especially is like not a top five worthy pick, but because he's a quarterback he could end up being one. And so it's like almost obviously not the same extent of bump, but like receivers I feel like are getting a bump too, where like Ladd McConkey has been mocked in like the late first round, which I like a Ladd McConkey, but
yeah, but I'm not spending a first on him.
Yeah, and so like I think like waiting and like having one of those guys just like see who's available in the second makes sense, but I think even in the third it makes sense because like I think there'll be like half of those names that you listed off like could still be available in the third round, and then there's like still good receivers like Javon Baker from UCF, Brendan Wright from USC,
Cornelius Johnson, Michigan. He's 6'2", 212, ran a 4.44, one of the best blockers in the class. They're late round guys. I'm glad you mentioned Javon Baker. Like you can find a productive receiver in the third round, you know, of this draft class. Like, I think what you mentioned being pushed up the board, I think that's the only reason why guys like AD Mitchell being, but no, even if you're the biggest AD Mitchell in the world, you can't convince me he's the 17th best player in this class. That's ludicrous, you know, and, no. And I like AD Mitchell, but he's not the 17th best. Like, yeah. There's, to me, legitimately no argument that you can make that he's one of the 17th. Like, it's can only be explained, like you said, like the McCarthy, you know, phenomenon. Like, he's literally only up there because he's a quarterback who, you know, doesn't involuntarily vomit on himself, you know, on big stages. In terms of some guys that I like who aren't first-round picks that we've talked about at 17, these are just guys that I've watched recently, guys that I'm fans of at other positions. Kingsley, Sua Matia, BYU offense tackle. I think, like, if the Chiefs took him or the 49ers took him at the end of the first, I think he's going to hit. You know, I'm a big fan of his. Christian Haynes, obviously, with Connecticut. He's not exactly underrated because yeah, I feel like he's, like, in the top 50 or 60 of every big board. But big fan of his. Javon Foster from Missouri. I know he's a guy the Jaguars have had some interest in. He's a guy I think makes a lot of sense on day three. Blake Fisher with Notre Dame. If the Jags don't take an offensive tackle with the first two picks, he's somebody I think that you should keep an eye on. I've heard that, you know, the team internally is pretty, you know, high on him. I'm not sure how high that means, but he's mostly been pegged as like a third round guy. He actually beat Joe Alt out to become Notre Dame's left tackle and then got hurt in the season opener. And didn't return until the end of the year. And they're like, oh, Joe Alt's doing great. We're not going to take him off the field. He moved to right tackle. I don't even think he's 21 yet. So I think he's a really, really high upside guy. We talked about Max Melton. Obviously, a big fan of his. Cam Hart, I think, is really interesting. Josh Newton with TCU. Renardo Green, I feel like everybody before knows that he's, you know, a good player. And then we talked about it some earlier in the week, but some of these, like, I feel like every year edge rushers are getting lighter and lighter. Like college football has really lost the plot on actual defensive ends. Two guys I like, Darius Robinson and Marshawn Nealon. I don't like Darius Robinson in the first round. Like, him attending the draft has me curious. But like,
yeah, that's Keon White all over again.
Yeah, I feel like he'd be a solid pick, though, at 48. I feel like, yeah, a big body in who can slide inside makes a lot of sense for Nielsen. And then Nealon, too. Nealon tested way better than Robinson. He obviously doesn't have the SEC pedigree, but I think Nealon, who I'm pretty sure they had in for a visit, could be a really interesting guy. So those are the guys I kind of have my eyes on right now who we don't talk about at 17.
Okay. Yeah. In terms of edges,
I haven't watched the guy they had for – I haven't watched Jalix Hunt, who the guy they had in for the visit. I don't know if he's anything.
No. Well, I just feel like a lot of the mid-round edge guys, like Idiza Isaac and Booker from Kansas, and there's Isaac, and then there's like a guy from – let me pull it up. There's Adiza Isaac, Braylon Trice, honestly, Jonah Ellis from Utah is who I was trying to think of, and then Austin Booker from Kansas. Like, these guys are all tiny. I think Gabriel Murphy is pretty small too. And so, like, I'll be interested to see. I mean, like, you just mentioned how we're the defensive ends and then linebackers too.
Yeah, they're lighter and lighter every year.
Smaller. And so it'll be interesting to see, like, whether the Jaguars end up taking kind of like a quote-unquote fastball guy like they did last year with Yashir Abdullah, versus someone like Nealon or Darius Robinson or Brandon Dorlus in the third round. My guy that I really like is Xavier Thomas out of Clemson. He's pretty old, but he's
a big time recruit.
Yeah, he's a good player. I feel like I see him mocked in like the sixth and seventh round, but I would love him in like the fourth or fifth round. I think Muhammad Kamara from Colorado State is the last edge guy I mentioned. I think he's like a better, I don't know, just body than those other light guys. So he can make sense with the Jags.
I forgot one name. The guy I think legitimately is probably the best possible option at 48, just by best player available. Michael Hall. I
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I feel like he's Michael Hall at 48 or one of these defense tackles at 17, I'm taking Michael Hall all day. Mm-hmm. You know, like he doesn't have the counting stats, but he has everything else. You know, he has good film. He has insane measurables. He was a big recruit. I think he's going to be a lot better in the pros as he was, you know, in college. Also, my other take, I would not draft any pass rushers in like the fourth or fifth like round. If you get to the sixth, I'll take like a freak or like a project who maybe hasn't done anything in sixth or seventh. But I think after the third round, you're probably not getting somebody who's like even worth rostering in most cases. Max Crosby is like the day three hit at edge rusher. Was he a fourth round pick or was he a third round pick?
Fourth round sounds right.
Okay, I think it does too. I really want him to be he was a fourth round. I want him to be a third rounder to defeat that entire argument. No, so he's like the day three hit at edge. Otherwise, it's like a 97% chance that that player is going to be nothing, right?
Do you have like character concerns coming out? Do you remember like why he was a third round pick, or if he like should have been a first round pick?
He went to Eastern Michigan.
Oh, there you go. Because I just know like for like at least defensive tackles. I mean, for edge rushers too. But like I think if you want like a good pass rushing productive defensive tackle, you have to take one in like the first round. Like Chris Jones was taken in the second, but he was taken late because of character concerns. And then, like, I think Javon Hargreave was taken maybe in the third round. I don't know why wasn't taken higher or lower, but like you really need to pay up for pass rushing production on the line. So I agree with you in general. I definitely agree with you with Michael Hall. I think like maybe he falls to the third round just because he doesn't have like prototypical size necessarily, but man, he's got some juice. He's got some pedigree. I would definitely be happy with him at 48. I think Chris Jenkins is like much closer to 48, the guy from Michigan, but I'll be happy with him at 96. He's just a good ball player. I like Mekhi Wingo from LSU too.
Yeah, as, like, I like Wingo a lot.
He's probably like the like last guy that I like really like. Yeah.
Yeah, I think Crosby is just a small school thing. I'm looking at, this is only one source, but PFF's top 15 edge rushers that year, they had Crosby at 12th behind Ronheim Bingham of Arkansas State, LJ Collier, Anthony and Nelson, Rashawn Gary at 8 with related article why Rashawn Gary is not a first round talent. then got guys like Zach Allen, Clelin Ferrell and Chase Rinovich like above him. So I don't know. He's just a rare day three hit at the position. Because if you're a good pass rusher, you're going early, you know, like you had said. So if they don't like pick an edge, I think in the first three picks, I think it's okay. Like not even picking one, honestly, like are you going to get like chances are how much better are they going to be than Yusuf Abdullah, you know, after the top 100? It's to me like that and quarterback are two positions. Like if you don't go early, I just, I know there are exceptions. I just think you're DOA if you don't go early at those two positions.
That makes sense. Do you have any takes on like the top of the class for the defensive line? Cause I talked about like Newton versus Murphy and then Latu versus Turner and Bears. So do you have any strong opinions on those guys?
I think Turner, has to go to the right scheme. Like Mike Caldwell would have loved Dallas Turner. You know, he does it. Like he's great on stunts, great in coverage. I think he makes a lot of sense for Raheem Morris. I think I saw a stat that was like Raheem Morris like dropped his pass rushes in the coverage more than anybody else. So I think he makes a ton of sense with him, but probably not for every team. Like he seems like a jack of all trades type instead of like a 12, 13 sack a year type guy. I like Jared Verse a lot. I think he's like a high floor guy. I'm not sure if he's like as high of a ceiling, but I think you're probably getting 8 to 10 sacks from him a year. So I think he's a good player. Latu, I think, is probably the best like pure pass rusher of the group. He reminds me a lot of Jalen Phillips coming out of Miami. Yeah. And Jalen Phillips had some similar question marks, you know, because he had left. I think it was UCLA that he left.
I think you're right. No, that's like a perfect comp because of the school, because of the injury concerns, but even like their play style too. Yeah. Like just
all their technicians.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm a fan of, you know, all those guys. I like Michael Hall. I'm with you. I have Newton over Murphy, but I think Murphy's going to be like a really good like sub package guy early on, and then he can obviously grow into it more. But I think both are, you know, solid players. Newton just has a super weird profile. Like, he's light and has zero length, so he's like an outlier. Yeah, but
I think he's betting. A top 10 talent, but he's probably like, I wouldn't be surprised if he falls to the second round.
Yeah, same, because the list of guys with his arm length who have succeeded is immensely small. But I was super down on Kalijah Kancey last year, and I'm already kind of eating some crow for that one. So I'm going to overcorrect in that facet. Fisk, I think, is like a good player, but it's insane to me to see him mocked in the first round. I'm like, to me, mid second round is probably where I would like take him. Like, he was impressive, like just like watching FSU as a casual viewer. Like, he popped, especially those last couple of weeks. So it didn't surprise me to see, you know, him get some offseason draft season hype. And then he obviously had the insane, you know, combine performance. Yeah, but there has to be a reason that he didn't pop off until 2023, you know. So and then I like Dorlus a lot as like a like tweener type guy. Yeah, yeah. I'm a Dorlus fan. I think he could end up being one of the best interior pass rushers in the class. Beside that, like Chris Jenkins, I'm with you. I wouldn't take him for you. He didn't really do it. Yeah, do it for me. It wouldn't surprise me if he became a useful player, but I'm just kind of meh on him.
Yeah, not at 48.
Yeah, that's about the extent of the takes I have on that.
Not on Sweat, I would say, while we're talking about defensive tackles, just because.
Get me started.
Well, even before the DWI, like, he was playing at such a high weight. I think he was like 360 or 370 pounds. And like, there's no defensive tackle in the league, I'm pretty sure, that like weighs that much nowadays. And so he was gonna have to like cut his weight down for the league, and then he just like didn't weigh in at the Senior Bowl. And then when he weighed in at the combine, it was like barely enough of a change. So there was like already question marks about how much he was really gonna like try to care about being a pro, and then he went out and got the DWI like last week, and so now I'm like, I already like did in the second or third round. I don't know if I'll take him in the fourth or fifth at this point.
I was gonna say there was already a good chance, I think, that he was gonna be like a fourth round pick, and everybody on Twitter would be like, how is this guy falling? When in reality, I think it was Dane Brugler who said like teams already like had discussions with him about partying and stuff like that, and then you know, put up the number that he put up.
Right.
Field Yates put out a really good stat in an article a few weeks ago. I don't have it pulled up, but it's basically like guys of that size like just don't play high snap percentages, and it's just like the value isn't there to play, like, to draft a guy who doesn't play a ton of snaps. Learn from Jordan Davis a little bit, maybe.
That's what I was thinking about.
Yeah. I don't know. I'd probably still take him fourth round, though, honestly.
He's a big guy.
Yeah. I'd feel okay with burning a fourth round pick. They're like, the fourth round is when I think I would start taking the questionable decisions. First, I wouldn't touch him in the first three rounds. I agree with you on that.
Yeah. Honestly, like, even just, like, I feel like the real draft is in, like, the first two rounds. And then everything after the first two rounds is, like, you're just kind of, like, picking projects /
players. The draft is luck. You're trying to get, like, there's no way anybody knows how these guys are going to turn out. You're trying to get lucky. With that said, there are teams that are better than others in terms of, like, attacking market value, certain positions, stuff like that. But I'll say till the day I die, the best way to be successful at the draft is to have more picks. Like, the Rams had a million picks last year, and they ended up having one of the best draft classes, you know, in the league, because they had enough, you know, lottery tickets that, you know, some of them ended up paying off. So I will say, though, the most hellacious day of my career was day three last year. In the Jags press box, pick after pick after pick, I was getting pissed that they weren't trading them. Dude,
I took the job as like site manager at Big Cat 2 weeks before the draft, so I was overwhelmed. I'll tell you.
Yeah, it's something. I guess you got any more takes in the chamber? I will say we'll see about recording again before the draft potentially, because we know the Jags are set to talk before the draft, and they always say something interesting. It was. at the pre-draft thing 2 years ago, where my thing walking away from it was like, oh, they're taking Trayvon Walker 1,000,000%. Like, they there is no chance to take Aiden Hutchinson. So I think that as we get to that, maybe we'll have something to talk about. If we don't, we'll see you guys around draft time. Gus, you got anything else?
No, I'm good. It was good to be back.
Yeah, no, it is. Thank you guys for bearing with us. As things get sorted out, we will be uploading more frequently, not just our podcast. We'll also have film stuff. I'm going to start dabbling back into it myself. You know,
I got like 80% through like Mitch Morse film. And then, I don't know, just like stuff came up, whether it was draft stuff or the Josh Allen extension. And so now at this point, like, since I've only watched one player so far, I'm probably going to save Mitch Morse and like other film stuff for just like the off season in a month or two. But yeah, it's coming. Don't worry.
I don't think anybody's really clamoring for it. Yeah, I think.
Yeah, that's what I was like, I'm just going to drop this.
Yeah. Yeah. When it comes out, it'll be perfect. But thank you guys for your patience. I just want to say, you know, speaking for myself, but everybody who listens and supports this podcast and everybody who listens, you know, to either one of us on anywhere or reads either of us anywhere, I want to thank you, you know, from the bottom of my heart for the support, the readership, the friendship. And I love you guys, even the knuckleheads who try me and act as target practice for me on Twitter. I learned that I posted too much when at my rehearsal dinner, one of my groomsmen, who is like a friend of like 20 plus years, et cetera, one of the people who knows me like best, was like talking about us growing up and what a hellacious kid I was. And he was like, he's now in his speech, he was like, he's now channeled that energy into bullying people on Twitter. So I'm like, if it made it to the rehearsal speech, probably turn it down a little bit.
Well, I mean, we're basically athletes, John, because we wouldn't be here without the fans. That's so right. I'm right there with you. I appreciate everyone who reads and listens and just supports in general.
Go read Gus's article, by the way, on the bulky balling of the Josh Allen contract. It's going to be the first thing I do when I get off here. But
there you go.
John Chipley, Gus Logue, thank you guys for listening. And don't forget, you just got bulky balled.